Chapter 3. 2 months after Charles' rescue, they initiate senior staff meetings. Because there are more of them, and because Yanis has found a restaurant he wants to try, mostly. But it's a good idea in principle, and Charles has been gone for a week, so Eric is looking for distractions. Not that he ever has to look far. Eric eyeballs the trendy, trying-too-hard atmosphere and resigns himself to microscopic food. He'll have to stop at Subway after. He's the last one there, and Emma doesn't even look up as she asks, lascivious as she leans into Yanis. And how is Jason? Flexible, Yanis says with relish. And Eric eyeballs the exit, but Azazel grips Eric's ankle with his tail. I hate you, Azazel tells Yanis, who smirks and waves over their waitress. Are you looking for a lawsuit? Eric demands. And Yanis smirks at him and then glances down at the silverware. Eric.
What?
Eric, take a deep breath, Emma says. And Eric looks down at the silverware, all of which was hovering by his hands.
Maybe a bigger one, Azazel says, looking over Eric's shoulder, and Eric twists. All the buildings on the other side of the street are leaning towards him. Eric lets them go gently.
Aren't you too old to have a power flare? Yanis demands.
Apparently not, Eric murmurs. And no, well, it's not that. It's just unconscious. A month ago it would have been a strain. Now it's a conscious effort to keep everything in place. Not so much a power flare as it's... He's finally unlocked.
A lingering gift from Dr. Xavier, Emma observes tartly, and then puts in her lunch order.
Did you stick your dick in it before he left, or what? Yanis demands, giving Eric his most pitying expression. The one that says Eric is stunted somehow, more broken than the rest of them in ways no one can fix. The one that says Eric can flirt with a psychopath, but hasn't had a relationship a day of his life that didn't involve a ghost. And it's all they want to talk about. They want to talk about the fact that Eric sleeps in Charles's room most nights at the hospital, and they're over-familiar, practically married.
No, Eric snaps, and gets up and walks out of the restaurant because he is tired of this.
He doesn't know. He just doesn't.
And Charles went home to Westchester, and Raven went with him to play nursemaid, and the only communication Eric's had in a week is a single stilted email in which Charles reported he was fine. Mentioned Eric should visit and bring him some of that soup. But it's a hollow request. Nothing genuinely meant. Done to be polite. Eric hasn't replied. Doesn't see the point. It's done. There are other people in the world besides Charles Xavier. Never mind that he's been Eric's world for nearly a year. And that's fine. Charles doesn't owe him anything. And Eric has never been good at going after people he wants. Not people he wants like that, anyway. In school, they'd been Warren Worthington, who had actual wings with white feathers and gold hair and clear blue eyes. He'd looked like an archangel, and laughed too easily for that place. Any overtures Eric might have made always stuck in the back of his throat. And the last time he saw Warren, he'd been sending him away, telling him to go, fly. Just go. Jesus Christ. Eric shoves the door open onto their floor.
Okay, you were supposed to be gone longer, Logan tells him. Also, you got a package.
What have you done? Eric demands, scanning the room quickly.
Sean and Angela clustered around Jason's desk laughing. Kayla Silver Fox is talking quietly with Aurora Monroe and Meeling Melanson about a case. And everyone else is out on assignment.
Or,
no, Eric turns back to Logan, lifting an eyebrow.
Wow, not me. Munoz.
Darwin.
Well, him and Summers and Gambit. Possibly Wade, because you know how he gets.
Eric fucking hates Remy LeBeau. Hated him in school as a smarmy prepubescent, and hates him now.
Logan, Why don't you tell me what's going on, and I'll refrain from putting you outside the offices like our very own mascot statue.
You're a fucking dick, Logan tells him. They're blowing shit up in the gym, so ignore the smoke. And your package is on your fucking desk.
Eric has a migraine. I don't want to be disturbed, he says. And Logan lifts his eyebrows but nods, and Eric likes him in spite of himself. Logan saw the shit show go down on the news and was waiting in Eric's office, smoking, by the time Eric got back to work. Apparently he'd wanted to join, which he made abundantly clear by telling Eric, I don't do teams.
Don't smoke in my office, Eric replied.
And Logan eyeballed the cigar and looked around.
Why?
Because I said so. I'm your new boss, and if you don't, I'll string you up atop the Washington Monument and leave you there in a lovely pirouette for the world to see.
God, you're an asshole, Logan grumbled, but it seemed to be a compliment.
He then stubbed out his cigar into his palm, because he wanted to be sure that everyone knew that his man pain was bigger than everyone else's, but he was too much of a badass to give a shit.
Eric considered attaching him to the Washington Monument on principle.
Now he shuts the door and glances at the FedEx package and the audits it's sitting on top of. There's a sudden influx in funding for their department, and if Eric can't get someone in Congress or the White House, he's going to have to look at Emma or Kayla or Jason, and he just can't handle it.
He sits at his desk with a groan and reminds himself that this is just a period of transition, that in reality this is all good, despite the fact that Janos keeps saying Eric's running himself ragged. There's never a minute to just sleep. And now that Charles is gone, there's no one to guilt him into taking a moment. And really, now that they've divided into the four teams, it's easier. Janos' responsibilities are lobbying, working with the Justice Department, intervening on behalf of the mutants already in the system. Emma's found herself in a similar position, though she's taking hers into the field more. She has ideas about getting Jason among people, and between her and Kayla, she's sure they can handle him if the need arises. It leaves Eric and Azazel to focus on the enforcement part, the policing. The nice bit is that it keeps Remy out from under Eric's feet, and with both Azazel and John Wraith able to teleport, they can be halfway across the world in a thought. It also keeps Jason away from Janos, because as hard as Eric is trying to ignore that, he's sure it's happening. Possibly in the locker rooms. No peace, but, well, Eric wasn't expecting any kind of peace. Hell, for him it probably wasn't even an option. But Charles is safe, and Shaw is dead, and it's a close enough approximation. They have time now. Time to shore up their defenses against the next idiot who thinks he's a god, fighting on their behalf against the humans. Fighting a war none of them asked for. It's inevitable that someone will take Shaw's place, and getting ready for it, it keeps him busy enough that he can ignore the loneliness that's creeping into his bones like ice. He reaches over and rips open the FedEx envelope, pulling out a plastic-wrapped Rolling Stone. Eric frowns and then slides it out of the packaging. Charles's face stares back at him, gaunt and fragile, unphotoshopped and impossibly vulnerable. By his cheek in stark font reads, Generation Mutant, Charles Xavier on the war being fought in secret. Eric opens it and then picks up the sticky note attached to the article. Eric, you still owe me soup. Charles. Eric gestures his door shut and reads it. And then he rereads it, trying to stare the words into submission, lingering over the final paragraph.
We live in a post-everything world, Xavier tells me. Small in the wheelchair he hasn't yet mastered barely 2 months into his life as a paraplegic. Post-feminism, post-racial, post-mutant. The culture wars, they tell us, are over. And for much of my life, the vast majority of it, in fact, I believed it. I never actively hid my abilities, but I never came forward as a mutant. In the file the CIA compiled on me when I was missing, I'm listed as an ally, but not as a mutant. The truth is that
that we are still discriminated against, but we cannot afford to hide, whether out of fear or out of a misplaced sense of security. I am a mutant. I am a telepath. And I won't apologize for it.
Eric gets up. Cassidy, you're in charge, he says as he heads out, takes a company car to Westchester, New York. According to Google Maps, it should be a 5-hour drive, but Eric does it in half that. Charles answers the door in a wheelchair, and he blinks up at Eric in surprise.
What the hell is this? Eric demands, holding out the magazine.
Ah, Eric, Charles says.
Yeah, Eric. What are you doing?
You read it then?
Yes, Eric says. I read it, and then figured this should probably happen in person rather than over a phone.
The entire house shudders, and Eric exhales through his nose. Are you having difficulties with your powers?
Don't do that, Eric says. And Charles has the grace to not pretend to misunderstand, if not the grace to look ashamed of himself for attempting so blatant a misdirect.
Come in then, please, he says, moving the chair back, manual-powered, sleek. Best money can buy, but still a chair, still a prison.
He should have stayed. McCoy could have tricked it out.
That's flattering.
If you minded your own business, you wouldn't be hearing that.
Then think quieter, Charles retorts, gesturing for Eric to sit in an overstuffed leather chair, settling his own chair across from it.
Eric stands. What were you thinking? Eric asks. Because that's the crux of it.
Someone has to, Charles says simply. Someone has to say something, and you simply can't. You're important where you are. You're necessary. He offers Eric a small smile, almost apologetic if you don't look at his eyes.
He doesn't regret a damn thing, the stubborn asshole. They'll come after you, again, Eric says.
Yes, they might. But it seems they're going to do that anyway.
I don't have time to babysit.
Eric.
You, and how did you get Rolling Stone to...
Eric.
Cover this. Jesus, Charles, what were you... Eric! What? Eric snaps.
Did I lie? Charles asks. Like Eric is still something wild, something he has to be careful around.
No.
If Charles is surprised by how easily Eric gives in to, then he doesn't show it. I had a lot of time to think, those 11 long months, he says. We cannot endure a man like Shaw. And unless the world sees another side to our kind, they will think we are entirely Shaw. The pendulum has begun to swing against us again, and... He cuts off, exhaling sharply. I had to do something. Surely you can understand that. Eric thinks about being willing to drown twice to see Shaw dead, about the fights and the paperwork, and the reality that he would do anything to see the people who come under his temporary care safe.
Yeah, he grinds out. Yeah, I get that.
I thought you might.
They share a sharp smile.
Eric doesn't quite know what to do with this. He can't save Charles from something that hasn't materialized yet, a phantom threat with only the promise of violence.
So, you drove 5 hours to yell at me, Charles says after a bit.
Shut up, Charles, Eric mutters.
But Charles is smiling, pleased with himself. And Eric thinks he looks good, better than he'd hoped. Laughing comes easily enough, the lines of it familiar in Charles's face, and he seems to have accepted everything, or rather, has chosen not to rage against it.
We should go grocery shopping, he decides.
Eric blinks. What?
Or you should kiss me.
What?
Charles just looks at him guilelessly, blue eyes wide, and laughing, but there's worry in the corner of his mouth. And that, more than anything, is what compels Eric forward. what makes him lean over Charles's chair and kiss him. No hesitation or pausing to make sure Charles wants, because Eric wants this like he's starving for it. Can't imagine anyone would be so cruel as to offer this if they didn't mean it. Least of all Charles. Charles's hand comes up to rest on Eric's cheek, tilting his face a little to deepen the angle, body arching into Eric. Eric goes to his knees and the chair is in the way and Charles breaks away, panting, frustrated. Upstairs, he says, and Eric doesn't have it in him to argue. Can't see why he should when he's wanted. Charles is too light, but he laughs, pressing wicked kisses to the side of Eric's neck, sucking and biting at his earlobe as Eric finds the bedroom, swearing at him steadily because Charles is projecting at him and everything that they can do. And Eric knows that, yes, everything works. Jesus, Eric, just fuck me. Getting them undressed is easy enough. Eric strips with ruthless efficiency, helping Charles with his trousers and socks until he's bare, spread on the bed, and looking at Eric with an arch expression. Are you going to join me? He asks. Would you carry on your own if I said no? Eric replies. And Charles smirks and lifts his right hand, licking it thoroughly before reaching down to jerk his half-hard cock. That is about the extent of Eric's restraint, and he climbs onto the bed, spreading Charles's thighs further and settling between them. Eric, Charles is murmuring, nonsensical, still working himself. Eric slides his hands up Charles's thighs, not sure how he'll feel, if anything, but he has to touch, has to feel this, feel Charles, have him, and remind them both that this is real. This isn't phantom touch and loneliness and astral projection. This is them, here. Eric holds Charles apart and licks into him, and Charles definitely feels that, judging by the way he starts swearing. Eric can feel the way Charles shivers, forces himself to relax around the intrusion. Eric, please. Christ, please. Charles pants. But Eric won't be moved. He's going to go slow and enjoy this, and Charles will have to endure. You're such a bastard, Charles swears at him, and Eric laughs. Complete and utter. Eric, please, won't you just... He breaks off when Eric starts fucking into him with his tongue in earnest, making these gorgeous sounds, and they need a mirror or a video camera, because Eric wants to see what Charles looks like while Eric's eating him out, is jealous for all of Charles. Charles was pushing something at him, and Eric lifts up to look at the loop Charles has grabbed and the condom. Fuck me, Charles demands. Every inch a spoiled brat. And Eric bites into the skin next to his belly, making Charles yelp and hit him and shove at the top of his head laughing. Eric is hard, but it's good to be so hard, to want it so badly. The knife's edge of arousal dulled a little by the promise that Eric is going to get to have this. Have Charles. I could fuck you, Charles points out. You would have to ride me. Either way, you would still be mine, Eric replies, working his way up Charles's chest, letting Charles pull him up into a dirty kiss that's more a clash of tongues and teeth than anything to do with lips. If you'd rather... Jesus Christ, Eric, just fuck me, Charles says, reaching down for Eric's dick, jerking him twice. Eric pulls away, laughing, and loops up his fingers, sliding one inside Charles. It goes easily. Another, Charles insists. I won't break. So Eric gives him another, scissoring and working him open, sliding back down the bed so he can watch his fingers disappear into Charles's body, can lick around Charles's stretched open hole, revel in the fact that he's going to stretch him so much further, open him on Eric's cock, and fuck him until he can't do anything but beg. Yes, Charles says. That, Eric. It should bother him, he thinks, that Charles is inside his head so freely. But he can't be angry, not when the flush has crept from Charles's cheeks and spread along his chest, when his dick is hard and leaking, even though it's been cruelly neglected. Everyone needs something to be truly stupid about,
For Eric, it's Charles. He looks debauched, and Eric leans in, fingers still working him, to press a kiss against Charles's lips, reverential. "Now?" Charles asks, and Eric shifts, rests between Charles's thighs, and gives him a considering look as he rolls the condom on and slicks his dick. "How flexible are you?" he asks. Charles just glares at him, but the answer is, "Very." Which is excellent and lets Eric spread him wide, open and accommodating as Eric pushes the head of his dick in. Charles's back arches, deliciously, mouth falling open and hands coming up to grip Eric's shoulders. His trimmed nails bite into Eric's skin, but it's good. Will be something to keep later. He slides in, inexorable, one long thrust, pausing to settle himself, to stop himself from coming like he's 15. Charles reaches down to grab at Eric's hips, squeezing, pulling, impatient. "Eric, move," he insists. Eric does, fucks into him with sure, steady thrusts, rolling his hips against Charles. Charles's hands won't settle, like he feels the need to compensate for his inability to push back against Eric's hips. He scores Eric's back, fists his fingers in Eric's hair, runs his hands up Eric's arms and across his chest. He keeps pleading, moaning, and encouraging until Eric has to kiss him just to shut him up. But then it's in his head, which might be worse. Charles grins at him, nipping at Eric's lower lip, eyes heavy-lidded but no less challenging. Eric knows he's muttering, that it's German, but Charles seems to get the impression anyway, understand that it's praise Eric is pressing into his skin. He reaches between them to wrap his hand around Charles's cock, but Charles pushes his hand away.
I don't need, Charles says.
Eric knows he's muttering, that it's German, but Charles seems to get the impression anyway, understands that it's praise Eric is pressing into his skin.
God, Eric, come on.
You're a slut, Eric informs him, and it makes Charles laugh, pull Eric closer. Oh, you've got no idea, he replies, all filthy promise, and Eric's hips stutter. He's damned if he's going to come first, but he might not have a choice with the way Charles is broadcasting the greatest hits of his Oxford years. He fucks in harder, burying his face in Charles's neck, panting, biting, stinging kisses just under Charles's ear, and that's it. Charles is coming with a strangled sound, shooting all over them both.
Come on, Eric, Charles encourages, sex sloppy,
and Eric's grip on Charles's leg slips just a little, bending him further in half while Eric pounds into him, and then that's it. He's done. Coming. He comes back to himself quickly, gingerly settling Charles's leg back down and stripping off the condom, throwing it in the waste bin and getting a washcloth.
You could have left it, Charles says, watching lazily as Eric cleans them both off.
They need a shower, but Eric doesn't think either of them is up to that. Maybe he should, though, before he...
Get over here now, Charles demands, dragging Eric up by his hair and pulling Eric's arm over his chest.
I'm staying, Eric asks, aiming for mild and ending up far too earnest.
Of course you are, Charles replies, sounding exasperated that Eric had ever thought this was a question.
Eric absolutely does not fall asleep, with a smile on his face.
He wakes up the next morning to Charles poking him in the side.
I hate you, he mutters, blinking his eyes open.
Yes, Charles agrees. Fetch my chair, will you?
Eric flicks his fingers and Charles hums against Eric's shoulder.
It's a bit strange, he observes, though Eric has no idea what he's talking about.
Eric is boycotting being awake because if he wakes up, he has to think, to be responsible, to interrogate this and what they're doing. But if he sleeps, everything is good.
He wakes up again to the fire alarm. It's fine, Charles says in his head. But it's too late, because Eric has already flown down the stairs and skidded into the kitchen, which, in fact, is filled with smoke, despite the French doors being wide open.
I thought I'd make breakfast.
and then declared it an enemy combatant? Eric demands, coughing and taking whatever it was off the stove, throwing the pan out into the ground somewhere, clearing the fire alarm into submission, and then running a hand over his face. Charles bites his lower lip. Eric?
What?
Perhaps you want some pants?
Which is the minute Eric realizes that he's naked, and that Charles is giggling.
This is so Eric's life. Eric goes upstairs and pulls on a pair of ugly gray, too-short sweatpants he loots from Charles's dresser, and then he makes them breakfast while Charles sits at the breakfast table reading the newspaper on his iPad.
So, you're gonna go talk to Oprah now? Eric asks after a while.
She's retired, Charles says absently. Anderson Cooper has a new show, though, and apparently he's expressed interest.
You should have security, Eric tells him.
I look into it, Charles says, which is a brush-off if Eric has ever heard one. He glares and puts the plate of pancakes down in front of Charles, rooting in the refrigerator for maple syrup. He returns triumphant, if not a little surprised at his triumph, because there's desolation, and then there's that refrigerator. They eat silently, Charles absorbed by the day's news, and Eric still not 100% awake, looking out over the perfectly manicured grounds of the estate, and realizing that for all Eric insists Charles acts like an elderly Victorian lord sometimes, this place has none of him in it. It all reeks of pretension, a lush grandeur, an almost vulgar display of money, all of it inherent wastefulness. There's nothing of Charles in the wood paneling, in the way the books are tucked behind glass and everything is made for display, like a museum or part of a museum exhibit, a story with such history that it couldn't be tarnished by modernization. Everything had to be kept hidden and closed, so the ghosts would remember their way through the halls. But Charles hadn't haunted this place. He had haunted the house Eric bought, the one with warm sunlight and worn wood floors, stairs that creaked comfortingly, and that looked old because it had been lived in, not preserved unnaturally.
"You shouldn't stay here," he says, and Charles looks at him in askance. "It's not good. Wouldn't be good for anyone to be alone in this mansion with the world's thoughts for company."
"That was quite poetic," Charles congratulates him.
"I'm sure I stole it from somewhere," Eric dismisses,
pouring a third cup of tea. Charles laughs. "Yes, well, perhaps I'll look into moving."
"Come home with me," Eric wants to say. He doesn't. He finishes his pancakes and clears up breakfast, and then sits with Charles listening to his voicemail, hitting 7 to delete every time he hears Wade draw breath. If it's important, he figures someone else will call.
"You should come back this weekend," Charles says as Eric gets ready to leave, pressing lingering kisses to the bow of Charles' lower lip.
"I will," Eric promises,
and drives back to DC considerably slower than he'd driven from it. "I told you he was fine," Emma says as he walks back in.
"And he got some. Nice," Wade observes, giving him an obnoxious thumbs up. "I may cry. Azazel, where's the camera?" Janos demands, and then actually looks for the damn thing.
"What was it about?" Azazel asks, and Eric holds up the Rolling Stone advance copy. Emma plucks it from his fingers, leaning against Angel's desk and soaking up the attention. "Division X is an all-purpose defender of the United States mutant population," she reads out loud, and everyone goes abruptly quiet, turning around to look and listen. "They lobby on our behalf to Congress, submit amicus briefs to the Supreme Court, and they go out into the world and find us. Help us. And yet they are a group of under 30 people, all of them under 35. They work with law enforcement nationally and were my own personal salvation, and there's no mutant rights group who does not recognize them. But out of necessity they are hidden away from the general population. And it is out of necessity. Division X is necessary to this country, to us as a people, to
the mutant population globally. We need our own heroes, and these people are that. But it is also necessary that we have a conversation in the open, and I suppose that's what I'm doing, initiating a conversation.
He's going to get shot, Azazel says flatly,
folding his arms over his chest.
I mentioned that, Eric says. He won't be swayed.
Our very own Gandhi in tweed, Kayla murmurs.
Useful, though, Jason says, and Eric lifts an eyebrow.
Jason glances over at Janos and then says, Well, diplomacy and reconciliation are best in the hands of the social leaders and politicians. It keeps them out of our hair while we fight the war.
He might be able to do it, Darwin says slowly. People are weird about telepaths, but...
Can't be so afraid of doing it that we let things backslide, Azazel agrees. Tell him to take another month to recover before he does Sunday morning talk shows.
Shaw is gone, and we need another voice.
Why not his? Janos asks, shrugging and rifling a hand through his hair. To be fair, Shaw wasn't in the dialogue, Emma starts.
Yeah, no, Jason snorts, boggling at her. That's... Yeah, he was.
He can't fight. Not like we can, Emma adds. And he defaults to cerebral anyway. He's an academic and a telepath. This is the logical step for him to take. She pauses, tilting her head. It's what any of us would do, though maybe not so well.
You hate him, Eric reminds her.
Yes, but, she says and smiles vaguely. You don't.
Wait, that was pointed, Janos says, sitting upright and staring at Eric, eyes narrowed. Also, and this is important, pay attention. Can you get it up?
Emma jerks her head around to stare at him, but Eric shuts her out, glaring. You fucked him? She demands.
Telepaths are territorial, Azazel tells Eric in confidential tones. Like rabid dogs. Perhaps I will make a study of it.
Die, Emma snaps at Azazel. If he can't use his legs, does that mean his dick doesn't work? Janos asks Emma.
Eric closes his eyes and brays for death as his entire staff begins to discuss his sex life.
Friday afternoon, Eric tells them not to call him unless there's an emergency and heads back up to Westchester. Wade calls him 5 times about the emergency in his pants, and Eric manfully represses the urge to kill him and satisfies himself with twisting Wade's blades into dull hearts. Raven opens the door when he knocks, arms full of groceries, because he stopped on the way. Charles's refrigerator had a lot of condiments, and the freezer was packed with frozen meals. Ah, she says, eyeballing him. Oh my God, what...
These are heavy, he tells her. And she steps back, trailing him to the kitchen.
Oh, my God, she repeats, narrowing her eyes.
You know where the kitchen is?
Yes, Eric agrees, putting things away and rooting around for a pot. He finds it and then has to wash it, because the layer of dust is so thick a simple rinse won't take care of it.
Charles,
she shouts and storms off in the other direction. Thank you for feeding me to the wolves like that. Charles says sourly in his head. Very gallant of you.
She's your sister, Eric replies serenely,
and turns the radio on while he cooks, drowning out the half-verbalized fight the ex-Xavier siblings are having on the other side of the house. On Raven's first day back, oh my God, you are fucking my boss, you tramp! I can't believe I took time off for this. I could be saving this for, like, a vacation in Hawaii. Charles comes in with her to thank everyone and to meet them all properly. He and Eric also have a screaming match in Eric's office about whether or not Eric is sending someone from Division X to play bodyguard when Charles goes before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs and the Committee of Mutant Relations to testify now that he's been deemed healthy enough to do so. Eric thinks Charles is an idiot, too idealistic, and yes, even now, even with his public presence only just beginning, some idiot is going to want to kill him.
Make a statement. Eric knows, because he is the one who Raven came to the other night with a stack of envelopes, her blue hands shaking in rage as they read ream after ream of hate mail, sorting between what might be a genuine threat and the chaff.
"Oh, for God's sake, Eric, I will be able to sense it," Charles points out, fingers pressed to his temple, because yes, they're fighting, but neither of them is going to fight this out verbally.
"Like you did Shaw," Eric shoots back.
"He had the helmet,
which can be recreated.
And don't you think someone wearing that kind of contraption will be just a bit obvious?"
Charles finishes, exasperated. "I don't need a helmet," Eric points out.
"No one with your mutation has been recorded."
"Which must mean they don't exist."
"I can't be seen as one of your lackeys."
Charles folds his arms and raises his eyebrows, mouth a fine line, and Eric exhales through his nose. "I'm taking lunch," he says, and Alex startles, looking up from his iPhone.
"Okay."
"For the rest of the day," Eric clarifies.
"Eric," Charles says, warningly.
"What? I'm attending as a civilian member of the mutant community," Eric says. "I'm a card-carrying member of..." "What am I a card-carrying member of?" he asks Sean, who twists his face as he thinks.
Brotherhood?" he finally volunteers. "Not helpful, Eric," Charles mutters, rubbing his forehead.
"The Brotherhood has a strict policy of nonviolence," Eric says. Charles snorts.
"Yes, towards fellow mutants," he agrees. "I suppose you're also a member of the Hellfire Club."
Eric glances at Azazel, who grimaces and nods.
That had been that week in Vegas when they turned 21. Eric's been fuzzy on the details. A little bit willfully.
"Christ, Eric," Charles sighs. Eric raises his eyebrows. "I'm attending in an unofficial capacity as a member of the mutant community and an American citizen."
"Are you?" Alex asks. "Technically."
"Dual," Hank says, coming out of the elevator. "His dad was American." "He wasn't." But Eric also engages in a policy of willful ignorance about the ways Hank has hacked the federal government's databases. It seems best for all of them. Charles looks at Hank a little despairingly, like he'd hoped Hank would be better than the rest of them, or had basic moral fiber. People don't last at Division X if they still have basic moral fiber. Eric heads downstairs to the showers and pulls on jeans and a t-shirt, grabs his coat and heads back upstairs, raising his eyebrows at Charles, who sort of pauses, like he hasn't seen Eric naked before.
"Civilian," Eric says, and Charles rolls his eyes.
"Yes, fine."
Capitol Hill security really dislikes mutants. Eric tries to explain this to Charles, who doesn't believe him until the metal detectors go off, when Eric walks through because something about him tweaks them. He's on 5 dozen cleared lists, but some upstart jerk-off always seems to be working and wants to delay things. And today is no different, even when Eric pulls out his badge.
"It'll be a sec," M'Lorio tells him, belly straining his uniform.
"I think you'll find he's been cleared," Charles says. And L'Oreal looks at him, stance shifting aggressively. Then he pauses.
"Yeah, look, man," he says to Eric. "Sorry about that. Can't be too careful, you know?"
"Sure," Eric agrees, looking at Charles, who's already moving down the hallway.
"Everything you know you learned from Star Wars, didn't you?" he asks.
Charles grins and bites his lip, and it's all Eric can do not to lean down and kiss him. The committee hearing room is big, bigger than the ones Eric usually gets put into, and he sits in the gallery, stretches out his legs, and smiles up at Senator Kelly, who narrows his eyes at Eric, leaning over to talk to an aide who comes down and says,
"Senator Kelly wasn't aware that Division X was providing protection."
"I'm here as a concerned citizen," Eric says. "See? Off duty."
"So your interest in Charles Xavier is political?"
I'm more interested to hear how people my tax dollars pay the salaries of treat a man who suffered at the hands of a government-sanctioned psychopath, Eric retorts, and she sighs. Mr. Lencher, this isn't an attack. Bet you 20 the press conference after name-drops me and implies, A, Xavier's a puppet, B, I'm angling to change the narrative, or C, I'm here pushing a homosexual agenda. Are you? Mutant and proud, he replies, and then shifts, looking away from her. Kelly's mouth twists in disgust when she reports back to him. Eric? Eric turns, and Warren Worthington smiles at him a little hesitantly. Warren? Warren Worthington is still unfairly beautiful, even when he looks a little uncertain. Hi, it's been years. How have you been? Fine. I'm fine, how have... Eric stumbles a step, and Warren puts a big hand on his shoulder, which doesn't help the sudden migraine Eric is experiencing. You okay? Warren asks, all American concern. He's wearing a long trench to cover his wings, though they shift under his back. Migraines. I get them sometimes. Eric manages, turning his head enough that he can glare at Charles, who's watching them with narrowed eyes. Right, Warren agrees. Jealous type? Apparently, Eric mutters. Knock it off. He's married, you know, 3 kids. Lives in California. Yes, as a trained investigator, I did notice the wedding ring. You weren't trained a day of your life, Charles shoots back, but the headache is gone, and he sounds conciliatory. So, we should talk after this, Warren is saying. Somewhere private? Eric asks, tilting his head and trying to read him. Warren looks nervous, guilty even. Yeah, Warren says in relief. Yeah, I'm in town until Friday, but we should, yeah, get coffee, catch up. You can bring... Maybe you should bring Dr. Xavier. I could take you guys out for lunch after this. Sure, we'd like that, Eric agrees mildly, pulling out his iPhone and pulling up his contacts, handing it to Warren, who plugs in his information and then gives Eric a smile, which, upon consideration, isn't as nice as Eric remembered. He sits down and watches the shit show unfold. The plustering politicians who think knowing a friend who's a mutant is the same as knowing shit about them, and Charles, who is quiet, eloquent, and exquisitely unyielding in his prepossession. About 3 minutes in, Eric has to put his hand in front of his mouth to control himself, because he wants to howl laughing. He hopes someone is TVing this so he can save it forever, especially when Senator Kelly says, "Isn't it plausible you were in on this?" Charles quirks an eyebrow. And my dastardly plan was to have myself kidnapped and tortured, then bolt myself into a machine, and I do mean that literally, and as a result become a paraplegic? I'm sorry, if you could elucidate further, Senator, I'm afraid I don't see the plausibility. Someone in the balcony whoops, and Eric bites on his cheek hard enough to draw blood to stifle the laughter. It goes on like that for an hour, before they decide maybe they've had enough, at which point Senator Nardowitz apologizes to Charles for the tone the session took and wishes him a speedy recovery. No one tried to kill me, Charles says when Eric finds him after they've all filtered out. People keep coming up to Charles, shaking his hand and expressing sympathies. Isn't that cloying? Eric, I can hear what they're thinking. Believe me when I tell you that the words are the most tactful part. People rarely censor their thoughts. What did your friend want?
To talk, which could be interesting.
Oh?
He seemed nervous.
Yes, you tend to inspire that, Charles agrees, watching a blushing young woman shy away from them under Eric's flat stare.
Not that kind of nervous, Charles.
I see.
And you're invited, he adds.
Charles stares at him, and then Warren comes up to them. They have a kid at Alcatraz, Jimmy no last name, whose mutation is negating the mutations in others. No one's sure how it works, but they're at Serum, ready for testing. Jimmy no last name is 12, kept in a white cube where people can stare in at him. Emma takes Aurora and Kayla with her to tour the facility, because Warren Worthington II is a misogynistic and will be less on his guard around women. Aurora comes back into the office on the verge of tears, though no one is stupid enough to comment. Kayla sits down at her desk and starts to make calls, and Emma looks at Eric and says, "They have government funding, as this is a project with high sensitivity." "The kid?" "James Rayo. He's the son of the lead researcher, though you can't find that anywhere. He lived with his father in Egypt until his father had an accident last year. Car, apparently, though Jimmy has his doubts."
"He negates?"
"Only if you stand within 10 feet of him." Eric closes his eyes. "They have children, presumably to test on," Emma continues. "Or convicts. I've given the data Aurora downloaded to Hank and Alex. They were arguing when I left, so we ought to have results in a few minutes." She exhales and then sits down. I think that we need to be public about this."
"We don't do public."
"No, but Xavier wants the job. Give it to him."
"It'll get him killed," Eric says, and it's true. Azazel is right. This is going to get Charles killed.
"That would be a feat, someone managing what Shaw couldn't," she observes mildly. "Put Logan on him."
"Emma."
"Eric, as much as it pains me to admit this, we aren't the ones best equipped to handle this. This is the second incidence of the government directly funding or intervening in a project to eliminate us. And I have the sinking feeling next week they're going to wage open war. Kids are already afraid to go to school, afraid to fight back. Someone needs to make noise. He's volunteered. Call him or I will." She leaves in a swirl of white, the bright blue lining of her dress peeking out as she walks away from him. He calls Charles, who is apparently so ignorant of the way the law works against them that it's frightening, and Janos and he have hours-long conversations in Eric's kitchen while Alex swears at a keyboard and Emma tries to stretch her range to California. "What are you doing?" Charles finally demands. "Trying to contact him. But apparently 3,000 miles is my limit." Charles looks at her for a very, very long moment, and Eric preemptively closes his eyes. "Did you want me to pass something along?" Charles finally asks delicately.
"You're fucking with me," Emma says flatly.
No, not as such."
"No, nope, you..."
She trails off and then glares at Eric until he looks at her. He can feel the narrow-eyed look peeling his flash off. He raises his eyebrows at her.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Without Cerebro, 3,000 miles.
"He's talented."
"Jesus Christ."
The rest of them eventually go home. Emma to her latest toy, Darwin dragging Alex away bodily. Charles looks at Eric, then at the clock.
"Don't be an idiot," Eric tells him, locking the door behind Darwin and Alex.
"I don't want to impose."
"Shut up, Charles," Eric says. "Order us something to eat."
Charles smiles, and Eric pretends he doesn't see it, until he remembers he doesn't have to, grins back, and leans down to kiss him softly.
"I just don't understand how they think it's acceptable that they
hold him there,"
Charles says later over pizza. Eric is too distracted by the way Charles inhales food to properly respond. He didn't notice this before. Maybe it's specifically pizza.
"You eat like my grandmother," Charles informs him, and then impatiently,
"Eric!" No, it's a gray area. He's not a human, so they can argue they're not violating human rights keeping him there, Eric says.
"What?" Charles asks, blanching.
Eric blinks at him.
Human rights tend to only apply to humans, Eric clarifies.
They have a child at Alcatraz acting like he's a lab rat, Charles says, soft and pained.
It's like they wrapped it up and handed it to you, Eric reflects. 12-year-old kid, Alcatraz. Even I could make a crusade out of that.
Eric, I'm not sure how this has missed your attention, but you could actually raise an army behind you if you were so inclined, Charles points out fondly.
Eric flaps a dismissive hand. Too much work.
Yes, of all the sins I've always felt sloth was your greatest. Charles deadpans.
Eric flips him off and steals the last piece of pizza.
Charles just doesn't move out after that. Over a long weekend when Charles is in New York doing talk shows, and then in San Francisco speaking to a rally, Eric has an elevator installed in the house.
Okay, he helps it along significantly.
It's more that he buys an elevator and hires someone to create the shaft, and then he just does the rest. And when Charles comes home and sees the ramp and the elevator, he drags Eric over and sucks him off right there in the front hall, Eric's fingers scrabbling helplessly against the wall. It works, and it takes Charles from sob story to social justice crusader with international recognition. In the weeks after, he's on the covers of Time, Newsweek, and The Economist, and has a Brian Williams special, goes on Jon Stewart. Aurora and Darwin come back triumphant from a meeting with California's governor to deal with the wording and protecting children as part of the Department of Social Services charter, and Jimmy is removed from both his mother's custody and the facility. He's adopted by Warren's older sister, who travels a lot but wrote to Warren faithfully while he was at Shaw's school. Warren was the only one who got letters every week without fail. Darwin signed off on it, so Division X didn't protest, and Charles met her and gave it his blessing. Eric has another round of meetings at Langley, arguing about Charles. Higher-ups who haven't been in the field in decades who keep insisting that Charles is just a flash in the pan. He's momentarily popular, but the public will lose interest. Charles will lose interest in this little campaign. And is it true Eric is living with him? Doesn't he think that will compromise things just a bit? Eric just doesn't say anything, because he learned a long time ago that it was the best way to deal with people who thought they were in charge. Then he goes home and slides into bed beside Charles, presses Charles into the mattress, and kisses him close and hot. He doesn't know. He doesn't know how to tell Charles that he has to do this, that Eric can't do this all alone, that he's invested now, wrapped up in Charles, has been for a year, back when Charles was an over-attentive ghost. He doesn't have an enemy now. But he thinks he's got hope or something to believe in, and there might. If he thinks about it too hard, he can't breathe. He'd do better with clear-cut battle lines and a clear enemy. And there's so much left, and there are so few of them doing anything. But he has Charles, and it's enough. The end.